We are continuing to talk about the Table of Nations as found in the book of Genesis, the 10th chapter, and continuing on with a sort of explanatory epilogue in the 11th chapter of the book of Genesis. We've talked about some things regarding the background of that, the structure of the book of Genesis, how we have actually some firsthand accounts in the book of Genesis that are preserved for us through the efforts of not only the original sources, including apparently Adam himself, but on down through the line until they passed into the hands of Moses to be brought together following a pattern that was ordained by God, that was desired by God, so that just as in that song, you know, the echoes from the call of Moses, echoes from the burning bush, that through his hand we know of these things from long ago, that each and every tribe on earth could receive a great new birth. And the God of every earthly land would not pick or choose a man, but supply his own answer to the great need that was produced in the Garden of Eden when man rebelled against God and engaged in sin. The story that we have, the backdrop of the story of the Table of Nations is the Great Flood, and the population of planet Earth being reduced to a single family, eight individuals who had survived together on the ark, a story that is not only very carefully and accurately depicted for us from firsthand testimony in the book of Genesis, but is also reflected in the mythological accounts of practically every culture on Earth. Some of them strikingly close in the details to the story that we have in the book of Genesis, and some of them far more imaginative, but nevertheless, stories of the great flood that destroyed all mankind, leaving only a small remnant, are pervasive in the cultures that we find not only all over the Middle East, but literally all over the world, including in the Americas here. The stories of the various tribes and nations that existed in the Americas in complete isolation from Europe, and the proliferation of the story over there. We have talked a little bit yesterday about the family of Japheth, and I gave a handout, as at least some of you saw it and have it, and I'm not going to recapitulate that, but just to illustrate the idea of overlapping lifespans. That's the ages that chart is based on are actually found at the end of the 9th chapter and the middle of the 11th chapter, but it was to illustrate the idea that having these overlapping lifespans, having some individuals, just a few that we know of, the sons of Noah and presumably their wives, who would live on the order of 600 years, and then having a few generations of people who were living on the order of 450 years or thereabouts, and then to suddenly have a transition to people who had these diminishing lifetimes on the order of 240, 200, 170, and diminishing lifespans would tend to create a certain mythological kind of environment. And we talked a little bit about how the name Japheth is retained in the cultures of some of his heirs as a mythological figure, as a figure of great power, as a titan in the mythology of Zeus and of the Greeks, rather, as a titan in the mythology of the Greeks, and as the ancestor of the human race in or at least of, I shouldn't say that, of the Aryan people in India and so forth, and how his name turns up in some of those places. And let's take a little bit of a look at the descendants of Japheth. If you have the little map that I handed out, it's not a great map by any means. It just was something that was easily reproduced and illustrated some of the points that I, some of the ideas that I wanted to touch on in looking at the descendants of Japheth. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on them because I doubt that there's a lot of need or desire to spend a lot of time on the names of each of these descendants. As I read a quote from William F. Albright yesterday, what's depicted here as far as the dispersion of the nations and their families is an accurate picture. It gives us an accurate picture of the dispersion of the various families of mankind that became the nations that ended up filling the earth. In the 10th chapter of Genesis, we have, beginning in verse 2, the sons of Japheth: Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. And then it goes on and gives some of the grandsons. Which name in that list is probably the most interesting, sensational, or controversial? Magog. Why? Anybody? What? Revelation 20. Okay. This name turns up in prophecy as well, right? It's in Ezekiel 38 chapter. It's in Revelation, in the context of a gathering of nations against the people of God. Two different stories, but nevertheless very similar. And because of that, there's been a tremendous amount of speculation and intrigue associated with that particular name of the sons of Japheth. I thought about, you know, taking time to write on the board and going down through this list and looking at what we know about each one of these, but I'm going to be fairly brief in talking about them. The first son of Japheth that we have here is Gomer. And there's not a lot of certainty from what I read about Gomer being especially associated with the nations, except for Samaria. Now, how many of you know a lot about Samaria? See, I one time tried to read Conan the Barbarian, and he was a Samarian. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, that's okay. It's an old fantasy novel that was written back in the 60s. But he was a Samarian, and that's about how much I really know about Samaria. But it's today the region is known as Crimea. It's up there around the Black Sea. And the name Gomer probably is the backdrop for that name, the name Samaria. We have, and the sons of Gomer that are listed for us then after this, in verse 3, we have the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz. And if you have the little map that I handed out yesterday, you'll see up in the upper right-hand corner in the area of the Soviet Union there, you'll see Ashkenaz being associated with the name of the Scythians, and several sources would indicate that that's probably a correct identification. And also the name Ashkenaz is probably identifiable over in the Western European region with the name Scandia, which becomes Scandinavia in our more modern times, but the people of Denmark. And in between there, the people of Ashkenaz were among the tribes that settled in Germany, and that's the association that the Jews particularly make. The Jews who lived in the German-speaking regions are remembered or spoken of as the Ashkenazi, and that name is especially associated with Germany and the various tribes that settled there. Not immediately after the Tower of Babel, which we're going to talk about a little bit today, the Tower of Babel, but over the time of scattering and populating Europe. Then we have another son of Gomer whose name is Riphath, and his name is associated with a people, again, I don't really know anything about, the Paphlagonians, and also with Carpathians, and those are not people that probably most of us are going to want to do a lot of research into, but nevertheless, there are historical connections there to ancient nations. Togarma is mentioned here, and Togarma is almost certainly the ancestor of the Armenian people and probably also of some of the Turkish people, the Armenians and the Turks being associated with Togarma. With Magog, if it were not for those other prophetic passages, we might not really know or care very much about Magog at all. Magog may be associated with the name Georgia, not U.S. Georgia, because, you know, places are named after places, but rather the region there in the former Soviet Union, the region of Georgia, in conjunction with Russia and Ukraine and all of that. In Ezekiel, the 38th chapter, Magog is associated with Rosh, and that's almost certainly an ancient tribal name that becomes the name Russia in our modern language, as well as being associated with Meshech, which is further down the line here in the sons of Japheth, but being associated with Meshech, which is the ancestral name of the Muscovy people, which is an ancient name of Russia, which is preserved in the modern city, Meshech, Muscovy, Moscow, sure, preserved in the modern city of Moscow. We have the third son of Japheth, Madai, who is the ancestor of the Medes, the forefather of the Medes, who are well known to us to some extent in the Bible because of the empire of the Medes and Persians. And John has made reference to that time frame in his lessons on prophets as he's talking about the background for Hosea. With the Medo-Persian Empire, we're talking about the time period from about 528 B.C. and down into the 5th century B.C. until really the rise of Alexander the Great in the 4th century B.C. But they dominated that part of the world, the Mediterranean world, for a couple of centuries there. The days of Ezra and Nehemiah and Queen Esther and the prophet Malachi, the Medo-Persian Empire. We have Javan mentioned here, and we probably, this fourth son of Japheth, Javan, is probably the one that we could know the most about and spend the most time talking about, simply because we have a lot of associated history. His name, the name Javan, turns into also the word Ionia. Remember that the Greek letter iota is the same as the letter J in the English language most of the time. It transliterates into a J. And the term Ionia, which is an ancient name for Greece, is from the name Javan. And he has these sons, Elisha, which that name probably turns into another ancient designation of Greece, Hellas. And you saw when Ellie was talking about the background of Hebrews there that there were some Hellenistic Jews. And Hellenistic means Jews who were Greek-speaking, Jews who had been brought into the culture of Hellas, of the Greek nation. And that was a very prominent influence within the Roman Empire as well as in the preceding Alexandrian Empire. But we have that name probably coming from Javan's son Elisha. We have also Javan's son Tarshish, and that is possibly, that name Tarshish is associated with Spain in antiquity, and this is possibly the family of Japhethites that settled into Spain. We have the name Kittim associated here with Japheth, which is the island of Cyprus. Do we know anyone from the island of Cyprus in the Bible? Barnabas was, of course, a Jew, but was from the island of Cyprus, and it's one of the first places that Paul and Barnabas preached the gospel when they went out together from Antioch was to go to the island of Cyprus there. But Kittim is those people who settled the island of Cyprus, again of the family of Japheth, the Indo-European people. Then we have the name Rodanim, and that name is also the same as Dodanim. It's over in the book of Chronicles. It's recorded with the D instead of the R. And the name Rhodes, again associated with the Greek culture, probably comes from this name. The Dardanelles, the straits there in the sea, the Dardanelles are probably derived from this name. But it's the northern Greek tribes that we're talking about here. The fifth son of Japheth, Tubal, is probably the tribe of the father of the Tibareni people, which is not a name that most of us are going to identify with or know much about. Again, Meshech, the father of the Muscovy people of the land of Russia, and Tiras, the father of the Thracian people, according to Josephus. Now, you add those up, and you get those people, again, that stretch from India and across the north and over into Europe. We're talking about the ancestors of most of us who are here today. Most of us who are here today are from that line of the family of Noah, from the Japheth line of the family of Noah. But it's the family that's treated most lightly here. And why is it treated most lightly here? I mean, Western European history, that's what the world is all about, isn't it? But it's the family that is treated most lightly here. And why is that? Because it's the family that has the least to do with the things that happened in the scenario of God's work through the Israelite people to bring Christ into the world. Either in terms of opposition, yes, we do have the Medo-Persian Empire playing a role, and we have the Greek Empire playing a role, and we have the Roman Empire playing a role. But as far as the people who are shaping events, we're dealing with people who are in that Fertile Crescent area, who are in the Middle East, who are in Egypt, and we are dealing with a story that has much to do with the families of Shem, of course, and the families of Ham. And tomorrow we're going to talk about the families of Ham that are listed here and their impact on the Israelite people, their impact on the Bible story. But for today, I want to think a little bit about this whole process of scattering that took place. You look on the map, if you have the map, or if you have a map of the Table of Nations. The map that I handed out shows the descendants of Japheth in square shaped boxes, that is rectangles and squares with 90 degree corners. And if you look at them, you've got them over to the east in Iran. You have the Medes and you have Ashkenaz in Iran. And I mentioned yesterday that the term Aryan comes from the same word as Iran. Iran is derived from the term Aryan, and the Aryan people of Japheth were the ones who settled in India and Iran. And in later times, by the time we come to the Medo-Persian Empire, I just said that was a Japheth family of Japheth Empire. And that's because even though the Persian Empire and Janice Shelton asked me a question about that yesterday, and on the map we find the beginnings of Persia down here with Elam, the Elamite people, who were of the family of Shem, a Semite people. But we're talking here in the 3rd millennium B.C. That's where the Persian people begin in the 3rd millennium B.C. is with the Semites. But over the course of the next millennium, over the course of the next 1,000 years, we have incursions of people from the north coming down into there, not just the Medes, but also the Aryans, the Parsi, various Aryan people coming down there and overwhelming the former Elamite culture. And by the time we come to the era in which we have the Medo-Persian Empire rising up, it is an empire of the family of Japheth, not of the family of Shem. So we associate the beginnings of that nation with the Semites, but we associate the empire that arose there, and the modern state of Iran for that matter, with the family of Japheth, because they were the ones who dominated in that region over the course of time and took over the culture and so forth, dominated there. And that's not the only place where that kind of thing is going to happen. That's not by any means the only place where that kind of thing is going to happen. If you look at the Hittite Empire, which is not the family of Japheth, but rather the family of Ham, up in the mid-top area, up in the area of Turkey, the Hittite Empire was a great empire from about the 15th to the 10th century B.C. The Hittite Empire was on a par with Egypt. They were approximately similar superpowers in their day. But if you look at what the archaeologists say about the Hittite Empire, they will say that it spoke an Indo-European language, that it is not a Hamite nation at all. And to me, that doesn't seem all that mysterious because, again, we're talking about the passage of more than a millennium between the time when the Hittites come into being as the children of Heth, the children of Ham, and the time when, in utter insanity, they build this incredible city in the middle of nowhere. It's one of the craziest empire plans I've ever seen. And it lasted for a while, but it was bound to break down and fall apart. But the kind of insane drive that led to the rise of the Hittite Empire, the real intention to conquer the world. And you can only go so far with that, especially when you have the kind of pride that they had. But over the course of 1,000 years, a lot of things change in any culture. How could you define the American culture in terms of 1,000 years? Well, you know, how much history do we have here? The Indo-European people who dominate the American geography today, it's a lot of things change over the course of time with the movement of peoples and with conquest and domination. And as we come to the end of the list of the people of Japheth here, we have a statement, which is what I'm going to use as a sort of a kickoff to talk about a couple of other aspects of this. The fifth verse, from these sons and grandsons of Japheth, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his nation, his language, according to their families, into their nations. Okay? Everyone was separated. Well, when were they separated? How did that separation come about? The storyline here, Shem gives us a sort of an epilogue or an appendix to explain the story of the separation. What had God said to Noah and his sons when they came out of the ark? Well, he had said in chapter 9, verse 1, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And then he went on to talk about what they would eat and their interaction with the animal kingdom being apparently different than it had been before the flood. But I want you, he said, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And we have here in the 10th chapter the account of being fruitful and multiplying and filling the earth, region by region. And as it says here, in terms of their various lands and in terms of their various languages, according to their families, into their nations. We talked briefly yesterday about a symmetry that I see here that I appreciate with the 70 descendants that are listed here and the 70 descendants of Jacob that went into Egypt, and Paul's statement about how God was preparing things when he set up the nations with their boundaries that God had in mind making a circumstance into which the gospel could come and be very effective. And it was an ideal circumstance that the gospel came into. And it was just the right time in all of history for the gospel to come and to proliferate and to spread everywhere. And that goes all the way back to what happened here, that God was indeed making it possible for each and every tribe on earth to receive a great new birth, as in that the language of the song that we sang a few minutes ago there. So the tribes and language and nations that are mentioned here in the fifth verse, those come about because of, as we read in the 11th chapter, because of this sort of postscript to the story. Now let's look at that, chapter 11. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. Well, I would hope that Noah and his family, you know, all spoke the same language, right? When they came out of the ark, I would think that sometimes, as was referenced yesterday, it seems like men and women speak two different languages, but that's another issue. It has nothing to do with this. It's the same collection of sounds and the same collection of meanings. We just take different things from it in the way that we interact with each other. The whole earth had one language and one speech. Well, where does language come from? Well, 40 years ago, a linguist and philosopher named Noam Chomsky, who was deeply involved in the analysis of language and the direction that language analysis has gone, made the statement that it seemed to be innate in human beings. Now, he's by no means a believer in God or creationist from anything of his that I've read, but this linguist, Noam Chomsky, observed that language seemed to be innate in human beings, that it just seems to be a part of what we are. And that certainly is my take on the account of how God made man in his own image. God is a communicator, and he created communicating beings. Now, animals in various ways and to various extents communicate with each other, but it's nothing like what human beings do. It's nothing like the way that we interact with each other verbally, and language also can involve nonverbal components, and you can even develop languages that are not verbal at all. Sign language is not a verbal language, and yet it is, in every respect, a legitimate language, a legitimate means of communication. But language seems to be an innate part of what human beings are. It shapes us and defines us in a variety of ways. Over in 1 John, the fourth chapter, John makes an observation about the way that we talk in comparison with the way the world talks. And he says, you know, if we were of the world, we would speak the way the world speaks, but we're not of the world. In 1 John chapter 4, verse 5, they are of the world, therefore they speak as of the world, and the world listens to them. We are of God. He who knows God hears us. He who is not of God does not hear us. Language, in a lot of ways, defines who we are and what we are. Jesus made much of every idle word that men will speak, and it being brought into account in judgment. Do Christians speak the same way as their contemporaries in the world? If you do, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. We ought not to speak the same way that people around us do. We have a different hope, a different expectation, a different motivation, a different desire. We are motivated to speak as those who have the Word of God in their hearts. And that means there are some kinds of things that we don't say. And I don't just mean foul language. I do mean foul language, but not just foul language. Things that tear people down, things that are destructive, words of gossip and words of hatred that stir people up and cause strife and envy and conflict. We are to be a people who mind their language. We are to be a people who are mindful of the fact that language is a gift of God and that we are to communicate truths of God, saying things that edify and build up and encourage. But language came to us directly from God. When God made Adam, Adam was able to communicate. Not only was he able to communicate, but his language was expansible. His language could grow. What was he immediately set to the task of doing? Naming the animals. And right away, his language was growing. And when God subsequently made Eve, because it looks to me like Adam named the animals before Eve came into the picture, and that was part of Adam's educational process, look, you're not like them. And if only, you know, mankind today really understood, you're not like them, you're not to behave like animals, you're not to be an animal. But at any rate, when God made Eve, if she came into the world with the same language construct that Adam had, then I think that Adam had to turn around and teach Eve the names of the animals he just named. And I actually think that that was the way God did it. I think that there was a purpose in that, in building a relationship between the two of them. But the language was capable of growth, was capable of expansion, and our language is like that too. If you're over a certain age, you probably find that frustrating because the language keeps changing around you and you don't quite know what people are talking about a lot of the time if they're, you know, younger than you are. And we don't always think that that change in language is a good thing. Actually, a lot of times we don't think that change in language is a good thing. The older we get, the less we appreciate the changes in the spoken and written language that are going on around us. But language is in a constant state of change. The family of Noah came out of the ark speaking one language. But God had in mind that they should scatter over the face of the earth. Have you ever had the experience of going somewhere in the United States of America where you have a common language with the other citizens of the country and finding that you could not understand what the person across the counter or in whatever position maybe they were, that you could not understand what they were saying? And so you might think of foreign immigrants to this company who have strange accents, but I'm thinking of an incident in Arkansas where I stopped for gas and asked directions of the young man who was pumping my gas. And when he finished giving me directions, I said, "Thank you," and went on my way and said to my wife, "Sue, do you have any idea what he just said?" And neither of us had a clue. We both knew he was speaking English, but we understood not a word that he had spoken to us. Well, that kind of a regional accent is easily demonstrable. We all understand about that. There's a certain homogenizing influence in our culture called, you know, television or radio or movies. There's a media influence that tends toward a certain amount of leveling in our language, in our culture. But it still is different from place to place, and it seems like the younger the speakers are, the more the differences are apparent, and I'm not sure just why that is, but that seems to be the case. The stronger the accent is, the younger the speaker probably is for some reason. But not only are there differences in accent, but there are also regional variations that end up growing into dialects over time, that people have particular expressions that they use that are not shared by other people who don't have their own set of experiences. Again, there's a certain leveling going on here, but you can appreciate that tremendously if you go to Great Britain or if you go to some of the other English-speaking countries of the world where they don't know that the hood of a car is the hood of a car. They think it's, you know, a bonnet. And where they don't know that a crosswalk is a crosswalk, they think it's a striped zebra and various kinds of things that, you know, and if it's got a hump on it, it's a striped zebra. But anyway, these kinds of differences come up over time. But what we're looking at here is not, if you just read the 10th chapter, you might assume that all the languages on earth just kind of grew up over time out of one common tongue. And that's not the case. And there's no good explanation for why there are different families of languages, except for the explanation that we have in the 11th chapter of Genesis. There's no good naturalistic explanation for why we have different families of languages on planet Earth. How many families of languages are there? I don't know the answer to that, but neither does anyone else. I've read lots of different numbers for it, anywhere from a dozen to 35 or 40 or maybe more, depending on what analyst you're looking at, because that kind of analysis is kind of subjective. But there are families of languages that seem to have distinct origins here on planet Earth. Well, they seem to, because they do. When we think about language, we think of language being made up of words, and there's, you know, it gets a lot more convoluted than that when you get into the analysis of language and how it works. But we are aware, I think we are aware, that, for example, it's been used as a joke so many times that surely everyone realizes that the Japanese does not make a real distinction between the sounds of L and R. That's been a source of many a joke. I'm not going to try and make a joke of it myself because I don't have any linguistic skill to do that. But Japanese doesn't make a distinction between the sounds of L and R. Those sounds are the same, essentially regarded as the same in Japanese. And we see similar things in languages that we're familiar with and close to. And for, you know, there are different sounds in Spanish than there are in English. Where do those sounds come from? If we go to the Hawaiian language, what I remember from an anthropology class a couple years ago, if we go to the Hawaiian language, what I remember is that the Hawaiian language is made up of 15 distinct sounds, 15 phonemes. Okay, the English language is made up of 35 distinct sounds, 35 phonemes. Does that mean the English language is superior to, more modern than, the Hawaiian language? No, doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't have anything to do with that, because you can say everything in Hawaiian, the original native Hawaiian language, is just as adaptable as the English language. It has nothing to do with the capacity of the language or the intelligence of the speakers or anything like that. You can say everything in Hawaiian that you can say in English. It's just as flexible, it's just as expandable as the English language is, but the sounds that they use are different. And where do those sounds come from? Well, have you ever heard a little baby? Those of you who've had babies, have you ever heard a baby speaking Chinese? Because they're born speaking Chinese and Spanish and Hawaiian and English and so on and so on and so on. And what I mean by that is that every infant that has the capacity to speak tries out all of the sounds of every language on earth. They all try them all out. It's been well documented over and over again. Every infant goes through a process of experimenting with every sound that is in every language on planet Earth. And what happens over time? Well, mommy and daddy get all excited when baby goes da, and they don't get all excited when baby goes kah. So what do? Well, baby learns that, hey, da gets a good reaction and kah doesn't. So they work on the sounds that get rewarded. And very quickly, they forget how to make those other sounds. But if they're taught multiple languages, you know, if they're bilingual in the household from day one, they learn both languages side by side with absolute fidelity. That's not the word I want, but there's some word I want, and you know what I mean. It comes to them very easily and very naturally to just pick up both languages side by side. They naturally know how to make both sets of sounds, and they naturally get the feedback, and they develop those languages side by side with great alacrity, with a lot of ease. And it's much, much harder later in life to go back and learn a second language, and especially to learn the distinctive sounds of a second language, which is why we tend to speak foreign languages with strange accents, you know, because we don't mimic those sounds of the other language very effectively. But where did all that come from? Again, there is no good naturalistic explanation either of why babies go through that process of experimenting with language sounds or of why those distinctive, really distinctive language groups exist. There is a good supernatural explanation for that right here in the 11th chapter of Genesis, but there is no other good explanation for why this has happened. People have speculated about language being invented multiple times by different groups of humans, but all of that is just malarkey. It's just foolishness. There is no reasonable and rational explanation for the origin of language except that God gave it, that he built it into us, and for the multiple distinctive families of languages that exist, except that, again, there is a divine intervention here that brought that about. The 11th chapter of Genesis, the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And Shinar is in the Fertile Crescent. It's the area that is better known in modern times as Sumer, the plain of Shinar. They dwelt there, and they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Ellie, what do you build with in Jerusalem? I know you don't build, but I'll let you be in the position of Moses here and just give you the credit for that part. Natural limestone, okay? And how much mud brick building is there in Israel? Not much. It just isn't done. All over Israel, what they build with, basically, historically, prehistorically, all through the years, has been stone. Why? There's lots of it. But if you go to Shinar, if you go to Sumer, do you have a lot of stone to build with there? You don't have a lot of stone to build with there. Well, I bring that up because the idea, you know, that some scribe in Jerusalem in the 5th, 6th, 7th century B.C. made this up is just, it's just dumb. This is how it was. This is how the kingdoms, the cities of the Sumerian Empire, this is how the early cities in the Fertile Crescent were built. They made brick and they fired them and they built their walls of these bricks that had the quality of stone. They lasted a long time. They were very durable. It was a very, very cheap building material readily available. This is what they built with. It's not what the Israelites built with, but it is what the Sumerians built with. It is what they built with in Mesopotamia. So they made bricks, and they baked them thoroughly. They had brick for stone. They had asphalt or bitumen or whatever for mortar. And they said, come, let's build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let's make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. What's the problem with the premise here? Well, there may be half a dozen problems in the premise here, but what's the problem in the premise? All right, God said, I want you to fill the earth, and they said, we want to hang together. We want to stay together. And why do they want to stay together? For greatness, yeah, for greatness. They want to really do something. Did God want them to really do something? Not exactly. Yeah, that wasn't exactly what he had in mind. They had really been doing something before the flood, and he didn't want them to really do something in the same way they had before the flood. He wasn't in favor of this pride and this pulling together and everyone working together to the same end, because what kind of end does that inevitably turn out to be? It ends up inevitably being about things that God has defined and described as wicked: human misbehavior, man dominating over his fellow man, and taking advantage of one another, and so forth. Let's build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Now, I do not think that this is saying, let's build a stairway to God. I don't think that's what they're thinking at all. When it says a tower to the heavens, I just think they mean a big, tall tower, a monument. Has anyone ever done anything like that? Well, we're still doing it, aren't we? Isn't it still a big deal to have the tallest building in the country or the tallest building in the world or whatever else? And the pyramids, of Egypt, this is the sort of monolithic constructs they were to lend immortality to their builders and to their occupants, if you want to call them that. And the same thing with the pyramids in South America, and the same thing with the ziggurats in Mesopotamia, which is probably what this is in Mesopotamia, in later years there, we find these constructs, these ziggurats being made out of mud brick, towers, stepped pyramids, if you will, which were used for what? What were they all about? They were, right, they had religious usage. They were places of sacrifice. They were associated with the idea of temples and religious ritual. And I think that's what we see happening here, is we're looking at a development of religious ritual that has nothing to do with God and with what is known about God. Noah, when he came out of the ark, he offered a simple sacrifice. He seemed to have some idea of what animals would please God, because he had taken clean animals into the ark, and that's the animals he used in the sacrifice. There was some knowledge, some awareness there involving that preceded even the permit to eat meat that came afterward. But this has nothing to do with anything that has involved previous interaction with God. This is all about establishing a new order and a new way of doing things, and it's all about humankind. And I think that things that we see in association with this are God setting limits on what man can do. They had this desire to build a noteworthy city, a city that would let them all stay together, and a tower whose top is in the heavens, to make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered. Lest we be scattered. We don't want to be scattered. Well, I think of another group of people who didn't really want to be scattered, and God did want them to be scattered. It's a whole different context than this, but it's in the book of Acts that I'm talking about. There was this tendency on the part of the early Christians to, let's have this mega church. That wasn't their terminology. Let's have this one monolithic group here. We'll all stay together in Jerusalem until the Lord comes again, It's not expressed that way, but they all saw the need to stay together and work with each other, and there was a need for that for a little while. But what convinced them to go somewhere else? As the Lord had said, persecution, yeah. The Lord had said to his disciples, you're going to be my witnesses in all the world. Preach the gospel to all the world. He had said to them, you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. But what did it take to get them out of Jerusalem? Well, it took persecution to get them out of Jerusalem. Could the Lord have gotten them to scatter some other way? Could he have, said, I want volunteers. I want volunteers to leave Jerusalem and carry the word elsewhere. I wonder how many people would have volunteered. I don't think it would have been anywhere near as many as what left and took the word of God with them and planted churches in their former homes when they went back where they came from. But God got them moving on that occasion, and here was a situation where the people didn't want to go and do what God said, and so God gave them a little stimulus to do that. Let's build ourselves a city. We don't want to be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Verse 5, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the Son of Man had built. And usually when it says the Lord came down, that means he sent an angel into their presence. Like in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and I have a suspicion that something like that happened, that the Lord came and moved among them and talked to them and saw what was going on, not just by way of knowing it, because he already knew it, but by way of sort of giving them a chance to declare themselves and their intent. And when he came down and examined what was going on there, in verse 6, the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. What's it talking about there? What can mankind do when mankind pools their resources? Well, they can sure do a whole lot more than they can when they are working alone or working in smaller groups. One of the basic reasons for spying is to find out what the other guys are doing so you can take their knowledge and build on it, add their knowledge to your own. And here we didn't have any need for spying because everybody's cooperating together. Everybody has the same goal, the same end in mind. And they're going to develop technology in a hurry. They're going to develop all kinds of technology in a hurry, as well as all kinds of other social constructs for the interaction with one another. And the development of civilization, if you will, was going to go along at a pace that God didn't want and in a direction that God didn't want. So God says, we're going to slow them down. We're going to slow them down by scattering them out. And he proceeded to do exactly that. Let's go down there and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Can you imagine the chaos? Here you are, working together, building a city, building a tower. You've got all these people working together. And on Monday, everybody's on the same page. Everybody can read, write the same language. Everybody speaks the same language. Everybody is together on the same page. You get up on Tuesday morning, and two-thirds of the people, or three-fourths of the people, or four-fifths of the people, I don't know what the numbers were at all, but they've lost their mind. They can't speak right anymore. What's wrong with them? Why can't they understand you? The most simple things, they can't understand you. And what's worse, you can't understand a bit of the gibberish that's coming out of their mouth. What happened to those people? It's like mass insanity has occurred. And you start looking around the city. Maybe your own family is all intact, because it does talk about, you know, the going out by families to begin these nations. But a lot of people that you used to be thinking, you know, that you had relationships with, you can't even talk to them anymore. Literally, you can't even talk to them anymore. Not just that you don't feel like it or don't have the same drives and goals, but you just can't talk to them anymore. And this has never been experienced before, not by these people. There probably had been different dialects in the pre-flood world because of the scattering of humankind and the growth of humankind. There probably had been regional dialects at least. But in this world, this is a brand new thing. This is a brand new experience because they haven't scattered over the face of the earth. They haven't developed multiple dialects. And all of a sudden, they cannot understand each other. And that would cause hostility, confusion, chaos. It says God confused their language. And that's probably one of those, you know, understatements, just a tremendous understatement, to look at what that would have done. But doing that, I think, involved rewiring the brains to some extent. Because as I said, in regard to infants, you know, when we're infants, we try out all the sounds of all the languages. And some of them we discard. And it's practically impossible to learn them again. And so what's happening here involves some kind of physiological change in the brain, and not just some kind of psychological change, but probably some kind of physiological change. And I mention that because this is probably the incident that we're looking at, and Peleg has already been mentioned a couple of times, and so I'll just mention that right now, that one of the descendants of Shem has the name Peleg. And we have in the 10th chapter, when Peleg is mentioned, that he's called Peleg, which is a word that means a type of division, because in his days the earth was divided. And Peleg is mentioned again in the genealogy of Shem in the 11th chapter, when it says that Peleg, in verse 19, after Peleg begot Reu, he lived 209 years. And on that little chart I handed out to you yesterday, he's the one that we went, that sudden generational shift from people living 400 and 50 years or thereabouts to people living 230 years or less or less or less. Something happened at the point in time when Peleg was born that was catastrophic enough to be memorialized in his name and was significant enough, or again catastrophic enough, that human lifespan abruptly was cut in half, just abruptly cut in half. Now, what could happen in our lifetime that would cause an abrupt cutting in half of human lifespan? Well, maybe the kind of change that would result in poor nutrition. You know, a lot of our forebears could have a life expectancy a lot shorter than ours because they didn't have the kind of nutrition that we have. They didn't have the kind of food available that we have. Maybe it was something like that, just of a natural order with the breakup and the scattering of humankind. But I doubt if that's the whole story by any means. Maybe it was something to do with cosmic radiation. You know, I don't know. There's no explanation here of why human lifespans were cut in half, except that it seems to be associated with God's determination. We're not going to let man do this. We're going to set limits on what man can do. Together, they're going to go too fast and going to go in the wrong direction, like, you know, children playing with matches. But in the scattering, God also seems to have set, because I do think that's what the name Peleg refers to, is the division of humankind. That's not the only possible explanation there, but I think it's referring to the division of humankind in his name. And that at that time there is this sudden radical change. Is it environmental? Is it physiological? Is it a combination of things? We don't have an explanation. We just have the raw facts laid out here that all of a sudden the son of Eber, who lived 464 years, he only lived 239 years. But this was a solution of sorts. That is, it didn't eliminate humankind developing nasty practices in their civilizations, but it slowed it down. It slowed the pace down. It limited the cooperation. It limited the communication so that that would go forward at a more modest pace, but go forward it certainly did. Nevertheless, this Babel is associated, of course, with one of the sons of Canaan, one of the grandsons of Canaan, and we're going to talk about the children of Canaan tomorrow. And which of the sons, or rather grandsons of Canaan, is this associated with? Anybody know? The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. That's in chapter 10, verse 10. Verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Verse 8, Cush begot Nimrod. Okay. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. I don't know. If the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Babel was where the confusion of languages occurred, did the confusion at Babel derail Nimrod? I don't think it derailed him, but it did thwart his plans to some extent. And we'll talk about Nimrod and his plans tomorrow in the context of the descendants of Ham and the impact that they had on the world. The world as we know it would be, well, it just wouldn't be the world as we know it without the things that the sons of Ham did, both good and bad. And we'll talk about some of those tremendous, I'll say contributions. I'm not saying tremendous means good, just very, very affecting contributions that the sons of Ham made on the world that we know, both its history and where we have come, the things we've accomplished. But right now it's time to switch over to question mode. If anyone has a question, then you have an opportunity to bring it up or a contribution that you'd like to make. Okay, up here. We have a microphone on foot here.
Are we saying that Peleg and Nimrod lived about the same time?
I think so.
And that's when the Tower of Babel was built?
Yes. Or putting that another way, yes, I am saying that. I am saying that Peleg lived in the time when Nimrod was starting his expansion and focusing on having that central point in Babel where they would all be drawn together religiously, along the same lines as what John was saying about Jeroboam the first yesterday, you know, establishing this new system where politics and religion run hand in hand. Okay. Anyone else? Microphone.
In Genesis 11, verse 7, it says, go to, let us. Does the us include Jesus?
I think when we look at that plural form that's often used in reference to God's actions, it is because we have the triune God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Yes. Yes, it includes the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The idea that this is the work of the Godhead, this is the work of God in every respect.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Up here.
My question regards the chronology of the Tower of Babel. My understanding is the flood was about. About 2,500 years before Christ. Is that correct?
If we do our best at adding up numbers, we come up with about that. Yeah.
And the pyramids in Egypt date to about that time. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And the Tower of Babel comes after the flood, and I'm not sure exactly when that happens, but it would seem to me like...
The Tower of Babel should precede the pyramids of Egypt, because the pyramids of Egypt are going to be the result of Mizraim, the son of Ham, starting an Egyptian culture, and the Tower of Babel should precede the pyramids of Egypt.
I don't understand how that works out. If they date 2,500 years before Christ, and the flood does also.
I'm gonna say two things. One is, I'm not real fond of pinning down those dates any more than John is, as he's been saying with the chronology there, because there are too many uncertainties. They're not huge uncertainties. I don't think the world is a million years old. I think the world is thousands of years old. But there are places here where there's a certain amount of subjective interpretation and connecting these things together. But if I say that about the text of the Bible, in terms of a little bit of subjective interpretation, in terms of archaeology, it's all about subjective interpretation, in terms of establishing ancient dates. I have read more than once, and I'm pretty sure it's true, that, for example, that Egyptologists don't use carbon dating. And do you know why they don't use carbon dating? It's because they already have a real solid idea of what the chronology is, and carbon dating doesn't agree with it. The two do not agree. And everybody else in archaeology is pinning everything on carbon dating all the time. You know, they're constantly using it. And the Egyptologists are saying, you know, we don't use it because it doesn't work for us. And there are lots and lots of issues, and I could spend all the rest of tomorrow and the next day talking about chronology issues, because there are lots and lots of mistakes and lots of subjective interpretations that go into pinning down ancient dates. And I'm not completely convinced, in spite of the traditional traditional English chronology, I'm not completely convinced that the pyramids were there yet when Abraham was there, which is more like 2000, between 1800 and 2000 BC. It seems to me that Abraham visited a pretty young Egypt when I look at the story of Abraham, that this was not yet the kind of empire that it becomes, say, after Joseph, that he's, anyway. There is a lot of uncertainty, and I don't really pin a lot on dating schemes because there are too many problems with all of them. Any other questions back there?
Yeah, would you kind of expand upon how people decided those families went to those different regions? I mean, because you're telling us that's what it is.
I'm telling you. In some cases, we can look at names and see the connection. As, for example, with Javan and the name Ionian, we can see an etymological, morphological connection between those words. In some cases, we have the testimony of ancient history. We have Assyrian accounts. We don't have any Assyrian account that is anything like as extensive as the Table of Nations here, but we have Assyrian accounts that have the same names, and we know the geography of where they're talking about. And so the connection is made through the Assyrian account, or through the Babylonian account, or through the Egyptian reference. You'll find, you know, a percentage of these in Egyptian records that pin down with the name or transliterated equivalent of the name that gives us a geographical region. You'll find in the writings of Josephus or Herodotus or who was the Greek guy that did the Egyptian history? Starts with an M, and I can't tell you it right now. Has to do with being over 50. But anyway, there are, and in cases where I said it without any questions, because it's really without any question. And in some cases, for example, saying if you say the name Germany is derived from the name Gomer, you can put a question mark by that, because maybe it is, but there's other possibilities for where the name Germany came from. If you say that the name Samaria comes from Gomer, there's not much question about that. There's a couple of thousand years of identification that go with that. It's not something that somebody in the 19th century suddenly said, ooh, look, this looks a lot like that. Although there are those, you know, and those are the ones that you put a question mark by. In fact, I'll mention a book by a man named Bill Cooper. Can't help smiling, Rick, when I say that. By a man named Bill Cooper. There's a book called After the Flood. Is that the right title? After the Flood, which I read several years ago. It's online. You don't actually have to buy it. You can find this if you search for Bill Cooper After the Flood. It's online. This man is not a scholar in the sense of, you know, having gone to school and gotten a professorship and all those kinds of things. He's just a man who was intrigued by an idea about the Table of Nations. And so he spent a certain amount of his life visiting places and looking up king lists and old historical data and so forth. And then he put together this book, and I printed it from the copy that's online so that I could read it on paper instead of reading it on the screen, because it's a rather lengthy book. But what I really enjoyed the most was the appendices of the book, where he lays out the various lists that he looked at and so forth. And a certain percentage of that book, well, a certain amount of that book is kind of sensationalistic. Do you know what I mean by sensationalistic? It's kind of like looking at a pile of rocks in South America and saying aliens landed here, you know. A certain percentage of that book is kind of sensationalistic. He draws conclusions that are not very, very solidly established. But there's also quite a bit that he found that he looked at, and I looked at it and said, hey, that's pretty cool to see the connection that exists. And he mentions a lot of historical documents in there. And it goes to the question that Dan raised. Not everything that he has in there is rock solid. He says so. He knows that. He wasn't necessarily trying to be sensationalistic. But a fair percentage of what he records in there, it got me excited about the Table of Nations several years ago the first time that I read it. I'd never been particularly excited about the Table of Nations before, but it made me say, you know what, this is worth paying a little attention to and appreciating the fact that the hand of God really was in this. And not only that, but that this information was preserved, just like the flood story has been preserved in many cultures, that bits of this information have been preserved in China, in India, in Iran, in places all over the world, bits of this information that could be cobbled together and rebuild a lot of what we have here. But it wouldn't be all of what we have here. Okay. Is that anyone else? Another question or anything on that? All right, I think we'll go ahead and take our break time. And you